Hello and welcome back to Compass Live, the only and therefore the best podcast dedicated to proof of work Bitcoin mining. Really excited for today's conversation. Just me holding down the fort, breaking into 2022. Today we have Dr. Mark Thornton, the Peterson Luddy Professor of Austrian Economics, a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and the author of Skyscrapers and Business Cycles. He's joining us today to talk about the ethics of money printing, specifically talking about Bitcoin mining and how Bitcoin mining works into the Austrian theory of economics. Thank you so much, Dr. Thornton, for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. And we're going to be talking about making money, my favorite subject.
Making money, indeed. So yeah, let's start off with ABC theory or Austrian business cycle theory. I think a lot of our audience just does not have familiarity with the topic. It's definitely more of a niche framework for viewing economics and often kind of lopped into the general libertarian framework of understanding both politics and economics. So again, our audience might not be familiar with it and just be thankful if we could kind of walk out maybe the basics of it and then also what the Austrian School of Economics is and the von Mises Institute.
Sure, I'd love to. The Austrian School started in Austria, and it's the oldest school of economics. It's also kind of fringe. It's the smallest school of economics, but it's also the fastest growing school of economics and the youngest school of economics, in that the average age of Austrian people supporting the Austrian School of Economics is younger than mainstream economists. And so we're the fastest growing, and we have the biggest audience out there on Main Street. So it's an alternative view, but yet it's an old improvement on classical economics of Adam Smith. And so it's really catching on. It's very popular on the internet. And if you want to get any kind of more details about it and snoop around, our webpage is the largest economic webpage in the world. It's mises.org. It's, as I said, it's the largest. It's got the most content. And it's all written for everybody. It's not a specialist technical journal type thing. And so I encourage you to, and your audience certainly, to come check us out.
Awesome. And totally. We'll put that in the today's show notes so everyone can go and look at the Mises Institute website. So let's kind of draw the conversation back into Bitcoin mining here in the Austrian school. So I think that the main things that are intersecting between Bitcoin and the Austrian School of Economics is the money supply, the question of money, and does the government have a role in issuing a money supply? Does the market have a role in issuing a money supply? What should the constraints be on this money supply? And Bitcoin obviously has a very conservative approach when it comes to issuing money. There's that famous 21 million Bitcoin cap on the supply. There's a very steady issuance that everyone knows ahead of time. You can always verify how much Bitcoin is going to be produced and has been produced. And that's askance the government model, which is print when we feel like it and print when we need it, and maybe print a little bit more just for fun. Can you kind of break down how the Austrian School of Economics thinks about money printing? Why does the government have a role or not have a role in the creation of money?
Well, if you go all the way back a few thousand years, money was something that emerged on the marketplace without the government whatsoever. It was just people looking for things that they could trade with other people, both locally and then, you know, further out into the region and then into other countries. They were looking for things that they could access themselves and then retrade with other people for the things that they actually want. So it was probably one of the most important inventions in human history. And you know, you and myself and your audience can't possibly imagine living life without access to some form of money. And so it was critically important. And then government, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years later realized, hey, if we could get our hands on this, it would be great for the king and for the army. We could just print up money, or maybe we could tax the coins that people were using and then shave a little extra gold and silver and copper off of those coins. that we could remint into new coins and then use to spend. And so government realized this, you know, going back for a few thousand years, and they've been controlling the money supply away from the marketplace ever since. And that's a bad thing, but for our purposes today, it's actually a good thing, because we know that governments down through history have abused this power of theirs. They've printed up and coined bad coins until the value of money simply disappeared and nobody was willing to use those primitive forms of money anymore. And, you know, through the Roman Empire is a great example, a couple thousand years ago, when they started essentially counterfeiting their own money. And eventually the copper content of their coins essentially disappeared. And the Roman Empire wasn't long lived after that. They disappeared as well into that hyperinflation. So governments have been abusing that privilege, that power, really, because they took it from the marketplace. The marketplace never offered it up. And so we have a long historical record. And just in our lifetimes, of course, we've seen hyperinflations. And we see right now the Federal Reserve has increased the money supply by trillions of dollars. The European Central Bank has, you know, printed up trillions of dollars electronically now, of course. So it's even easier than in the days of coins and even in the days of paper money. Now the central banks just simply make a decision and they type in some orders on the computer, and instantaneously money appears in people's accounts. And it solves their problem temporarily. But of course, the longer term problem we're living through right now, because we're going to the grocery store, we're going online. I was online with Amazon and I couldn't find three things that I had previously purchased were no longer available by the company and size. And then again, we see prices increase on Amazon. We see prices increase locally, at the grocery store and elsewhere. And so we're feeling the first negative effect of all this money printing right now in a significant way. And that's been happening for, as I said, thousands of years. And of course, in recent time, the boom-bust cycle and the general malaise of the economy has encouraged the central bankers and, of course, the politicians behind them that provide them with the power to print up trillions of dollars. And so that's the government model of things, where they ultimately will destroy the money. They could destroy the U.S. dollar as an effective medium of exchange or money. And they're in the process of doing that, and they show no understanding of the negative things that they're causing in the economy. Even, you know, a few percentage point increase in CPI inflation, consumer price inflation, they don't take any responsibility for doing that. So you can't rely on them to control the money supply in our favor. They'll only control the money supply in their own favor, in Congress's own favor. If they need money, they'll print it up. If we have a problem, good luck. They're not going to help us. And now we're paying higher prices for everything that we buy. And there's no indication that those price increases aren't going to continue. So that's the government model.
Yeah, you pulled on a few different threads here, and I kind of want to follow each down its own path, but unfortunately don't have time for that. One thing that was interesting, though, is you did bring up digital money, and we quickly are entering a paradigm where money has become completely digital. Cash is escaping everyone's pocket, not only because they're spending it, but because the government is yanking it out of their pocket and not printing physical cash anymore. they're just making dollars online or euros online and using that as a means of payment. And consumers increasingly are also demanding that, right? We see that payment platforms like PayPal are only increasing in popularity. At the same time, those two worlds clashing creates a lot of privacy concerns, creates a lot of concerns around the government control of money itself. And that's where Bitcoin kind of comes in here as this third option that says, hey, we can have digital cash, we can have digital money, we can have a digital monetary network, but we don't need government to control that. And there is a long line of tradition within the Austrian school about how the market would create its own money. This like ex nihilo return to the market creating its own money, which, as you mentioned, we haven't had in thousands of years. I want to go to that point and get your thoughts on it. I noticed in an article that you wrote a few years ago, and we'll include in today's show notes, that you yourself and other Austrian academics expected that something like Bitcoin would develop in the near future, but it happened a little bit sooner than you all predicted. Can you kind of walk me through how the Austrian School of Economics thinks about emerging monetary systems, thinks about emerging money from markets versus from government?
Sure. As I pointed out, money is a product of the marketplace, and improvements in money have always led to improvements in the economy and more economic development. So, you know, we were using gold and silver. Then we somebody came up with the idea of using coins. Other people came up with the idea of paper representations of money that is in the bank. In the Middle Ages, they came up with the idea that you could carry your money indiscreetly longer distances to make trades for better goods at better prices. So one of the things we want to keep in our mind is that a better form of money will, in the marketplace, win out, and it will lead to better economic performance. It will lead to better economic integration of the world economy so that we can all benefit from the resources and the talents of people from around the globe. So that's the general background, and it's the general lesson that we want to understand. And so Austrians have always been a big supporter of things like the gold standard, because the gold standard meant that money, either in transactions or paper transactions, electronic transactions, was something that was a great store of value. It was easy to transport. It had all of the great properties, and governments couldn't just print it up and reduce its value. So we've always been a big proponent and supporter of the gold standard and silver money. And we can see that directly, as your listeners know, in Bitcoin, because in other cryptocurrencies, because you have to expend real resources to get gold. And, you know, cryptocurrencies, it's the same thing. You have to expend real resources, your time, your money, computing power, electricity. People are scouring the earth to find places where electricity is cheaper and where brain talent is cheaper and all the rest, where computers are maybe inactive and accessible. And so it creates a scenario where the money, in order to create more cryptocurrencies, you have to expend more resources. And it mimics the gold standard perfectly because, for example, with Bitcoin, as we get closer and closer to that 21 million limit, it becomes increasingly more difficult to get additional Bitcoins. You have to expend more resources, just like gold miners have to spend more resources trying to find gold, trying to dig deeper, trying to get sources that aren't necessarily the easiest ones to find, to dig up, and to melt down into actual coins. So we think that the innovator of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin was thinking along the lines of Austrian economics, when they put together the paper and as Bitcoin started, the main ingredient with respect to Bitcoin and the gold standard about requiring real resources, whereas the Treasury can print up $1,000 bills and it almost costless, you know, to produce. Whereas we know that gold and crypto requires real resources, so nobody's going to be able to just print them up out of thin air. And so that particular aspect of Bitcoin, we think, is something that was gleaned off of an understanding of Austrian economics, along with the resource cost and along with the deflationary type pressures that Bitcoin and the gold standard put on the economy, because it's difficult to mine in both cases. There's a tendency with these better forms of money for the economy to grow faster than the supply of money. And we expect, therefore, that the purchasing power of money units will actually increase over time, as it did under the gold standard, and that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies would have something of a support to its value that would increase over time. So once you reach the 21 million coin limit and the economy grows as a result of that new technology, essentially, and better form of money, as you said, you know, we're all using electronic means much more than we ever did, and that's only going to continue, whether it's natural and efficient on our part or whether it's government mandated as a way to tax money on the part of government. There's this deflationary pressure that's going to result. And as a result, crypto coins are going to have a tendency, once we get into some kind of long-run equilibrium, certainly, of deflation, which means prices are going to fall and the purchasing power of our dollar, or excuse me, our Bitcoins, are going to increase. That's a real mix-up, saying the value of the dollar is going to increase.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
But so that's, you know, so we feel that the inventor of this technology and of Bitcoin specifically was inspired by the Austrian School of Economics. And that's one of the reasons I'm so happy to come on this program, because, you know, people who are mining coins and investing in coins and using coins, they know some of the ins and outs of this market. They know that real resources are expended, but they don't know what the inspiration was. And so, you know, you can make a lot of money doing a lot of different things, but if you know why you're making money, then in the future, you'll always be able to make more money. If you have the right ideas, those ideas can carry you forward and profitable until you just decide to take it easy and kick back and retire or something like that. So the ideas behind it, I think, is what really inspires me. And it got me excited about this whole situation back in the early days of Bitcoin. And so I did lots of just regular radio station interviews. And I wrote about it, and the article that I sent you, I just noticed on rereading it that it refers to Bitcoin being under $1,000. So it wasn't that long ago, but it is a few years old. But everything else, all of the you know, the talk about its nature and its technology, hopefully is correct and will be something that doesn't go out of style or doesn't go, you know, down the history memory hole, but that the ideas that inspired its inventor and inspires, you know, really all of us, and it, you know, the idea that the market's going to take back control of money is so very exciting in this time when the mainstream media is just reporting on what the government's doing, how it's expanding its budget and its power and its authority over our lives. You know, it just really run amok. And so the government that Mises and Rothbard talked about was really so much better in their lifetimes compared to what we have right now. But we also have technologies like Bitcoin that are a major threat to the government.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up a few points that I want to follow up on. One of them being the supply of Bitcoin being a known and steady amount. Nobody can print more of it. It's on a set schedule. There's also that cap. And that does fall in line with the Austrian School of Economics. And we know from like reading Satoshi Nakamoto's emails and his forum posts and all that cypherpunk material that he was indeed like, encouraged by Austrian theory. But I want to turn towards the opposite question, the fiat take on all of this. Fiat money, which is money created by the government. It's just printed by authority. There's no real resources behind it. It's just quite literally that paper printed with ink and a seal. And we've seen it throughout time just be a source for government power. And then later down the line, we kind of see like those bear bull cycles and empires crash because of it. The critique to all of the Bitcoin talk and the deflationary talk and gold talk would be that fiat money has done well, has done tremendously well in America to kind of bring up the middle class, or it's done a lot to create these bull markets that bring people their standard of living upward. And a lot of people attack the deflationary spiral that can happen from having a deflationary money like Bitcoin. So I want to kind of get that devil's advocate on the record here and go from the opposite side and have you explain why Bitcoin and gold is different than fiat money.
Well, yeah, you know, there's you can have progress even if you have a fiat money. Now, there are fiat money regimes that have just completely fallen apart both recently and through time. And that's more or less consistent. But the best money amongst all of the fiat currencies, you can definitely see economic progress occurring simultaneously, but it's not because the fact that money is fiat. It's just that some fiat regimes are more stable than others, and we just happen to be by far and away the biggest world military power and biggest economic power. And so our dollar has been relatively stable. It's something that, you know, it's a world reserve currency in that central banks hold it as part of their reserves. It's the world trade currency in that most international trade takes place in terms of dollars. But we've lost ground since we were on the gold standard prior to in the 1960s and before, when we were on the gold standard, we had those special positions. And now we are those special positions in the world in terms of reserve currency and trading currency were slipping. So even the US dollar is slipping in terms of its influence. And if we look at the middle class, frankly, there's a lot of reasons why our middle class is not doing all that well and why we see imbalances in the distribution of income. And we see the socialists and the progressives complaining about that incessantly. Thomas Piketty's big book on capitalism, attacking capitalism, saying we need to tax wealth and all the rest. Well, they do have a few points. And one of them is that income distribution in the U.S., for more than one reason, has been less stable since 1970 when we went off the gold standard. And so if you look at their graphs, you see that most of the problem that they've been referring to in terms of the distribution of income has occurred after we went off the gold standard. So the fiat money, certainly, even though there's more reasons for that than just gold, you can't credit the fiat monetary system with helping the middle class, because for very real reasons, the middle class has been hurt, and the upper income and wealth categories has been helped because they've been able to borrow money at a very low rate for their investments. So they've been doing extremely well. The middle class is not. So that's not a benefit of fiat money, certainly. And then the boom bust cycle, you talk about how the booms, sort of facilitate the financing of inventions and technologies. That's all true. But the boom bust cycle means that inevitably you're going to get this bust and you're going to create economic, social upheavals in the wake of these booms. So you're going to create bankruptcies. You're going to create unemployment. You're going to create foreclosures. You're going to create unemployment. And so, the negative effects of the boom bust cycle, yeah, some people are going to get rich in the process if they get out in time. But, you're going to hurt many, many more people. You're going to cause social dislocations, people losing their business, people losing their job, people losing their profession, people losing their houses. And, sometimes when you become unemployed, just because of the natural tendency for the economy to change, within a few years, your job may have disappeared entirely. So, the boom bust cycle has, I guess it benefits a few people who get in early and get out early enough so that, all of their stock options and their portfolios get protected in a lucky sort of way. But the negative downsides are tremendous. All the buildings that get left undone or are left empty, all of the resources that we sink into those new inventions and so forth are a tremendous loss. And they're a psychological loss to a lot of different people. So I don't see the boom bust cycle. In fact, even our friends in mainstream economics, even the Marxists, think that the boom bust cycle is a bad thing. And, it was always the panacea that people hoped for is how we could do away with it. Was it a natural force in capitalism? People didn't understand it. It wasn't until the Austrians in the 20th century, starting with von Mises, realized that it was central banks tinkering with interest rates in the money supply that caused these booms in the first place. And then his student, F.A. Hayek, went in and really did the nuts and bolts work about capital and about financing of things and about technology. That he showed all of, that this wasn't just a three-factor cause and effect thing that most people couldn't figure out, but that it was really, really integrated throughout the economy. And he won the Nobel Prize as a result of that in 1974. So the Austrians have explained the boom-bust cycle, and we've shown that it's not necessary, that we could do away with most of it just by a sound monetary system and a market-based interest rate in the economy. So the boom-bust cycle is not a benefit, and it's not a benefit to the middle class. And I've forgotten the part three of your question. I'm sorry.
No worries. No worries. I'll actually kind of pivot the question a little bit. You okay. brought up the changing of interest rates, which and the government control of money supply. The repercussions for that is often misallocation of capital, where a business person can get a loan from the government at a discount rate than the market provides, and they go and do something with that capital that the market otherwise just doesn't value it. It doesn't value it at that percentage of interest. It doesn't value that capital, and that capital is always misappropriated. And it creates these things that, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Austrian school calls them zombie companies, where they're only living off of cheap capital and cheap credit. And taking a look at our picture right now, we've been, before this pandemic, we're in the longest bull run in U.S. economic history, about 10 years, or modern economic history, rather. And now, since COVID happened, and we've seen just tremendous growth in all these money markets, even crypto, even Bitcoin, but also mainstream stocks, how do you kind of put those two together? Do you think that Bitcoin itself has been really wrapped up inside this money printing bubble, and that there's going to be kind of a price to pay for that? Or are we seeing some of that adoption that a lot of people are talking about? I don't know if you have an opinion one way or the other, or another entirely different interpretation.
Well, the first thing that I'd point out is that 10 years sounds like a long time, and it's well beyond the average length of the boom phase of a cycle, for sure, but it's not unprecedented. The entire 1960s were basically an economic expansion, and everybody thought it was great. And the Keynesian economists said that they had, you know, done away with the business cycle, that they had killed the business cycle, and they even took it out of the college curriculum. There used to be courses on the business cycle. And the Keynesians of the 60s and early 70s thought that they had somehow done away with it. And they took it out of the curriculum, whereas it's an integral part of the Austrian curriculum. And so a 10-year expansion is hardly unprecedented. We saw similar things, you know, in the 1990s with the tech stock movement. And we've seen a similar thing today. And I don't think the expansion would have lasted as long as it has this time had it not been for the central bank, the Federal Reserve, from inaugurating several unprecedented, untried monetary policies. And the same thing is happening in Europe and Japan, where Japan is really, you know, buying up its own stock market to keep things looking okay. And here in the U.S., it wasn't just reducing interest rates to zero for as far as the eye could see for as many years as possible, but they were also engaged in quantitative easing, where the government, the central bank of the government, was buying up mortgages, and they own a huge percentage of our mortgages have just been taken out of the marketplace. And they're also buying, you know, other assets in the economy. So, yeah, I mean, if interest rates are zero and the government has become the biggest buyer of assets, then asset prices are going to go up. But you understand the picture if you look at out at reality, and you look and you see, well, you know, things are okay in tech stocks. Obviously, everybody's giddy in tech stocks, but elsewhere, everybody's got nothing but question marks and nothing but uncertainty. I was listening to Bloomberg Radio on the way in, and they were talking about how the most advanced bond market the world has ever known, which is U.S. government bonds, has nothing but question marks, has nothing but uncertainty. And Bloomberg's head guy of bonds said the watchword in today's market has been uncertainty. So, you know, they, you know, the best, the most talented, the most experienced bond traders are in the world are saying that their market is just nothing but unanswered questions. And so that's where we are right now. And, you know, we've got lots of dislocations in consumer products, in the supply chain, in labor markets. Everywhere you look, the government has created chaos. And the fact that there's chaos in all these markets shouldn't be a big surprise, given the types of unprecedented policies, you know, in home prices. Let's look at home prices. Well, the government buying up everybody's mortgage has pushed mortgage rates down to ridiculously low levels, even for a non-inflationary economy. But mortgage rates are half of what the consumer price index inflation is in our economy. So they've created nothing but chaos. And I expect that eventually all of that is going to be revealed. You know, you mentioned zombie companies that are kept alive by low interest loans and government subsidies. Well, the general term we use is mail investments, and that's M-A-L, not M-A-L-E. But it's just bad investments that seem to be a great idea right now, but will be revealed in the due course of things with normalization of interest rates and of profits and losses not turning out the way they thought they were going to turn out. So costs will rise, and that's, we're seeing that, prices of consumer goods, prices of labor, prices of land, prices of a lot of resources are rising. Commodity prices have risen. As a matter of fact, you know, another fact that never gets reported in the mainstream press, and you would have expected it to be reported around the end of last year and the beginning of this year, as far as I know, it wasn't, was that commodity prices actually outdid stock markets, U.S. stock markets last year. And nobody raised a peep about that. I expect that to continue. That's going to put pressure on people. Higher wage rate pressure because people can't find workers for profitable businesses. And then, of course, there's the problem of people's purse or their pocketbooks. The fact that they have gotten raises, that they have gotten government subsidies, and now they're finding out that their incomes and their savings that they accumulated over the last year or so are not going as far as they thought they would because of higher consumer prices. And so eventually, you know, that means that fewer Americans are going to be able to afford a $1,300 iPhone or a $75,000 Tesla. The way that everything, you know, a few, even a few months ago, with people's portfolios, you know, at record levels, you know, it didn't seem out of the ordinary for someone to pony up more than two times the amount of money for a Tesla or, you know, for a $1,300 iPhone.
Yes, just to go back to, actually, before we move on from this subject, I do want to ask one question when you have a second about Gresham's law and its relevance here with the changing of money supply. Is your piece doing okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, cool. Awesome. So yeah, Gresham's law is often kicked around on Bitcoin Twitter, as we like to call it. And it's just the idea that there's always going to be a flight to harder monies. And Bitcoin is the hardest money ever conceived in a lot of people's estimation, where fiat, you can print it. Might be able to move easily, might make your needs pretty simple, but you can print more of it. Gold, you can always mine more of it. Bitcoin, you can mine more of it, but it's dropping and there's a supply cap. So it's the hardest money. And there's always going to be a flight to the hardest asset. I'm wondering, just based on my last question, if we're in a super bubble and asset prices are bid up, does that mean the same for Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin also bid up, or are we seeing a flight to a real hard asset right now? It's kind of two conflicting ideas hitting each other. It can be kind of hard to pick out which one's actually happening, and maybe both are happening in different ways, but be keen to get your analysis on that.
Yeah, well, Gresham's law, you know, the street version is that bad money drives out good money. But that's only the case when there's a fixed government ratio or exchange rate between one money and the other. There is no fixed exchange ratio between Bitcoin and the US dollar. Those things can fluctuate. So we eventually feel that, you know, in a positive light, that Bitcoin is going to replace fiat money, and that the government will adopt some kind of cryptocurrency, and, you know, and that Wall Street will adopt their products to it because it has more positive technical features that we really do want, even if we're not trying to make money as an investment off of that. So the economic scientist and the policy advisor, they're all pro cryptocurrencies. And, you know, they provide a benefit. And so, but right now, Bitcoin and others are, you know, it's in mostly an investment vehicle rather, or a savings vehicle, which are both important, but, you know, there's also going to come a time when it's got to become a dominant transaction vehicle. And I think that will happen, but it hasn't happened yet. So as you say, there are a lot of concurrent factors that weigh on the value of Bitcoin, just as there were and are various factors that weigh on the value of the dollar. I mean, who would have expected the value of the dollar over the last couple of months to be increasing rather than decreasing? So, you know, there's all sorts of forces out there. Now, what I expect is that, you know, as people take more money out of the stock market and start spending it on houses and Teslas and so on and so forth, that as that money gets into the economy, you're going to see even more consumer price inflation in terms of the dollar. And that's going to be supportive of Bitcoin if the stock market starts to when the stock market starts to come undone. You know, there's going to be a flight to harder assets. Bitcoin's going to be a hard asset. Government 30-year bonds are going to at least temporarily be a hard asset. And commodities, commodity producers, commodity suppliers, gold and silver, those are all going to benefit in terms of it being a hard money that people are going to flee to in bad times. And just simply rebalancing portfolios means that, you know, there are a lot of people out there with no gold and silver, no inflation hedges. The number of people who don't have any crypto, any Bitcoin whatsoever. I get so many Facebook messages, podcast requests, or just talking to friends of people who have never even considered Bitcoin, but they realize how much it's gone up in value. So they're interested, and now they want to know how. But literally, well, I can't say that because I know a lot of people who have been interested in Bitcoin for years and have used it. We've used it here at the Mises Institute for transactions and memberships for, you know, a number of years. Donations is a common thing too, where people donate their Bitcoins or in other assets that have appreciated in value, and to be above board with the tax authorities, they want to take those deductions to offset their regular income. So, you know, as all of these factors play out in the economy, and it's not just the U.S. economy, of course, but think of what's going on in China, where they're cracking down, where the Marxists are cracking down on entrepreneurs. They've been in the mindset of getting out of China and getting out from underneath the communist state over there for a long time. They've been moving their money, and one of the best ways that they'd like to move their money when is with Bitcoin. And they've come up with all sorts of other ways to do it, but believe me. And then Russia is another one where they, you know, the people who have money are never sure whether or not the regime is going to take it all away. And even in the U.S., there's that kind of pressure as well. You know, is Elizabeth Warren and her clique going to come to power and put a Thomas Piketty 70% wealth tax on the economy, or OAC, who wants to do pretty much the same thing? So there are some real things that are going to cause some real jumps, you know, once it becomes known and obvious that they're cracking down. And I fully expect everybody to try to crack down on Bitcoin. Then there's going to be huge move ups. But the main thing, you know, is that all of these outside values, these tangible values. And I would include Bitcoin in what I call tangible values. They're all going to benefit from the printing of the Federal Reserve, and the, you know, all of their activities, and then higher prices in the economy, stock markets melting down, and international troubles. All of these are going to benefit Bitcoin going forward.
Bitcoin is the honey badger, as they say. So we're getting close to 50 minutes, top of the hour pretty soon here. And so I do kind of want to ask a few wrap-up questions. The first of all being that that article that we kind of mentioned earlier from 2013, 2014, I believe it, when it was published, you stated in it that Auburn, which I believe you're a professor at Auburn at that point or currently?
Yes.
You said that you believe the students at Auburn, their sons and daughters will be using Bitcoin to buy hot dogs at games, which was a pretty bullish statement for back in 2013, 2014. And even today, that's still a pretty bullish statement to see it, say that Bitcoin will be used for just basic purchases. I want to get your thought on that. Pretty strong statement, obviously, like I just said. What kind of gives you this level of conviction that Bitcoin is going to be that dominant money that kind of takes over, that there will be at least Bitcoin as an option to be purchasing even a mundane thing like a hot dog at a Friday night football game?
Well, you know, I live in a college university town that's dominated by the university. So there's lots of young people around here, you know, and they're not oblivious to the problems of the future. You know, the national debt, let's say, you know, and I've had several students who, after taking my course, you know, their main career goal was to leave the country. And so I'm in that type of environment, and I'm at the Mises Institute, where that's our business. That's what we educate people about. We educate across the board of important things, but this is certainly one of them. And money is probably the highest priority that we have. And so I'm within an environment and have been for a decade now. We had a Auburn Bitcoin Club here, I think it was in 2011. Wow. So it's been around me for a lot longer than it's been around. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I even get questions now from people who had never heard of it until they found out how much it had gone up in 2020 and 2021. And so I have a poor sample of the way it's impacted people in the economy. And like I said, we've been taking Bitcoin here at Mises for many years. And so I guess, you know, it's a little bit of a surprise to me that I'm sort of in the cutting edge of what is to come. And of course, we also study the problems that government is imposing or might impose on Bitcoin and the miners and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it's not beyond the pale that, you know, within by the time you go from 2014 to 2034, I think it's a no-brainer that people are going to have the ability to make small transactions in Bitcoin just like they do anything else. And, you know, that pace of activity has only increased. We have small investment houses that specialize in these products. And Wall Street has embraced Bitcoin to a certain degree. Even the Federal Reserve realizes that there's a limit to what they want to do against Bitcoin. They realize that, you know, this is a worldwide phenomenon and no country is going to be able to effectively bottle it up and still participate in the market benefits of the coming decades. And so, yeah, I'm very bullish. And I think that, you know, that the idea that Bitcoin becomes one of the dominant forms of money or cryptocurrencies in general is not an outlandish leap of faith. And especially over that time period, every time I set a prediction or a goal for Bitcoin, it always comes true before I think it's the case. And the opposite is the case for my predictions and my feelings about traditional investments and about the boom bust cycle. I'm always, you know, claiming that the stock market is going to crash and it doesn't crash for another 2 years, or that we get, you know, high rates of consumer prices increases, and that doesn't happen for 2, 3, 4 years. Mm-hmm. So typically my predictions are always too early. But with Bitcoin and all of the technology associated with it, things come true a lot faster than I ever thought. So that idea about 20 years, using it to buy hot dogs in Auburn, I think that's going to come a lot faster. Those kids are going to be in high school or maybe even younger by the time they start making those kind of transactions.
Bitcoin for hot dogs. You heard it here first. Dr. Thornton, I want to thank you so much for your time. Where can our audience find your written material, your podcast, or anything else that you publish?
Well, of course, we have a lot of great podcasts on economics and history and business entrepreneurship here at the Mises Institute. As I said, we've got the most content of anything. We have a daily article that everybody can subscribe to. I'm on there, and some of the best writers, and best, by that I mean in terms of correct economic reasoning, you'll not find any place that's better in the entire world. And just reading our daily article is going to keep you really quite informed broadly about the economics from the Austrian school. We have a great Facebook page. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Mark Thornton and DrMark. And all of our primary people are also on Twitter raising hell just about every single day.
Good stuff. Yeah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for bringing your info to this audience. I want to call everyone to subscribe and like to our YouTube channel. It really helps other miners like yourselves find this information and get it before the correct audience. Dr. Mark Thornton, thank you so much again for your time, and looking forward to chatting with you again soon.
You're welcome.
For all of us at Compass.
Great.
Perfect. And for us at Compass, that's a wrap. Yeah.